Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. U.S. to launch investigation into Afghan hospital attack. Washington says it will launch an investigation to determine if their airstrikes targeted a hospital run by the medical charity Doctors Without Borders that left at least 22 people dead in northern Afghanistan. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter spoke with reporters yesterday.
This is a tragic loss of life. Your hearts can only go out to innocent people who were caught up in this kind of violence. And then a determination that, as far as the United States is concerned, and as far as our forces are concerned, that we be full and transparent about our investigation, and also that we hold accountable, if there is someone to be accountable, anybody responsible for doing something they shouldn't have done.
Officials in Nigeria say at least 74 of the country's citizens were killed in last month's stampede at the annual Hajj in Saudi Arabia. Nigerians are mourning the dead and awaiting news of other missing relatives 11 days after the tragedy. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
According to the latest figures from Nigeria's Hajj Commission, 74 Nigerians died in the stampede and another 64 were injured. News reports indicate Nigeria suffered more casualties than any other country in sub-Saharan Africa. And the death toll may still rise. 244 Nigerians who went to the Hajj remain missing, and the commission says 85,000 pilgrims from Nigeria went to Mecca this year. In the northern city of Kaduna, many have friends or relatives among the dead. Yusuf Yakubu Argasiu, the executive director of the Muslim League for Accountability in Nigeria.
Everybody feels sad. Of course, you know, we are Muslims, and when such things happened, we completely surrender to God Almighty.
Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
This is VOA News. A double suicide attack Sunday in southeastern Niger has left at least 8 dead, including 4 bombers in the city of Diffa. It is believed to be another spillover attack involving jihadists from Boko Haram, which operates primarily in Nigeria. Niger has joined Nigeria and Cameroon in joint military operations to defeat Boko Haram. Turkey said Monday a Russian jet had violated its airspace near the border with Syria, leading to 2 Turkish F-16s escorting the Russian plane out. Dorian Jones has more from Istanbul.
Turkish government officials say the country's military radar locked on to the Russian jet and Turkish Air Force F-16 fighters were scrambled to intercept it. A Turkish official quoted in the media said its jets would have engaged, but the Russian plane returned to Syrian airspace. Under current rules of engagement, Turkish forces can attack any warplane operating from Syria that breaches its airspace. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu warned Russia against future violations.
Türkiye'nin engagement kuralları, ister Suriye,
Let me put it bluntly, Davutoğlu said. Turkey's rules of engagement are valid for Syria's, Russia's or another country's warplanes. He added that whoever violates Turkish airspace will be subject to the necessary actions. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Russia's Interfax news agency quoted the Russian embassy in Turkey saying the incident did happen and that explanations were made to Turkish officials. The U.S. Coast Guard says it has found the remains of one crew member in its search for a cargo ship that sank off the coast of the Bahamas last week. Coast Guard spokesman Mark Fedor says the body was recovered in a survival suit found floating amid debris from the El Faro, which disappeared in the eye of Hurricane Joaquin. Mr. Fedor says searchers recovered a heavily damaged lifeboat belonging to the vessel, but found no people or other signs of life. The death toll from last week's massive landslide on the outskirts of Guatemala's capital has risen to 131. Officials say young children and newborn babies were included in the toll. The landslide struck a village about 15 kilometers east of the capital of Guatemala City. The first of the Nobel Prizes for the year has been announced. The Nobel Committee in Stockholm has awarded the prize for medicine to scientists from Ireland, Japan, and China. William Campbell from Ireland and Satoshi Mura from Japan shared the prize for their discovery of a novel therapy against infections caused by roundworm parasites. China's Tu Youyou discovered a drug that has significantly reduced the mortality rates for patients suffering from malaria. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhiben. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, warns the number of people being displaced worldwide by conflict and persecution is spiraling at a time when aid agencies are too broke to help them. The High Commissioner has opened the annual refugee conference with a plea for more financial support to tackle a myriad of global refugee crises.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from the conference in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Kenya's teachers and students have returned to class after a five-week teacher's strike was suspended. And pro-democracy activists urge continued support for civil society and election monitoring groups in Africa.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the European Union's border control agency Frontex says it needs nearly 800 more guards to deal with the growing migrant and refugee crisis. It says 630,000 people illegally entered the EU so far this year. Frontex says it needs to reinforce personnel in Greece and Sicily, two main entry points to Europe from North Africa and the Middle East. The European Union holds a summit next week on policies to deal with the migrant and refugee flows. Also, the German newspaper Bild says Germany could receive as many as 1.5 million asylum seekers this year. Bild says it is quoting from a confidential official document. Germany's interior minister would not confirm the report, but said the winter months could slow the influx. Meanwhile, there's another report of a boat tragedy on the Mediterranean. Libya's Red Crescent Society says the bodies of at least 95 African migrants have washed ashore over the past 5 days. Most of the bodies were found near Tripoli. More than 2,600 people have died this year crossing the Mediterranean to Europe. Most of the refugees and migrants coming to Europe are from Syria and Iraq. 2 million Syrian and Iraqi refugees are currently in Turkey. That's where many prepare for their trip to Greece. EU leaders are meeting with Turkish officials today on helping Turkey better deal with the crisis.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, warns the number of people being displaced worldwide by conflict and persecution is spiraling at a time when aid agencies are too broke to help them. The High Commissioner has opened the annual refugee conference with a plea for more financial support to tackle a myriad of global refugee crises. Lisa Schlein reports from the conference in Geneva.
This video of people fleeing conflict and persecution provides a moving image of the desperation facing tens of thousands of refugees forced to uproot themselves from their homes. When Antonio Guterres assumed his post as UN High Commissioner for Refugees in 2005, there were 38 million displaced people around the world. Now, 10 years later, there are more than 60 million refugees, asylum seekers, and internally displaced people. Over the past 5 years, the UNHCR reports 15 new conflicts in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and elsewhere have broken out or been reignited. It estimates the number of people globally displaced by conflict every day has nearly quadrupled in that period. Guterres says it is becoming more difficult for the world to ignore the plight of refugees since Syria's 5-year-long civil war has been brought to European shores, triggering the biggest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. He highlights the reluctance of Europe to deal with today's refugee crisis by noting how quickly and humanely European countries responded to and assisted 200,000 Hungarian refugees who had fled to Austria and Yugoslavia in 1956.
What was possible then, when Europe was still recovering from the worst war in human history, should also be possible today. Over 500,000 people have arrived on Europe's shores since January. in a continent of more than 500 million inhabitants, 5,000 people arriving daily is a very significant number, but it is not an unimaginable one, provided things are properly managed.
Guterres notes the European refugee crisis is just one of many. For example, he says millions of people have become refugees or internally displaced over the past year alone because of conflict in places such as South Sudan, Yemen, Central African Republic, Nigeria, Ukraine, and Afghanistan. He says the UNHCR and other aid agencies have received less than half of the money they need to provide humanitarian assistance to 82 million people around the world. He says the humanitarian system is not broken, as some argue, but he says the humanitarian system is financially broke, and that must be fixed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. The Associated Press reports that the death toll from a stampede during the Hajj in Saudi Arabia a week ago has risen to more than 1,100. Initially, Saudi officials had counted more than 750 deaths when large crowds of pilgrims suffocated or were crushed when they converged on a narrow road near Mecca. The AP count rose over the weekend as Iran claimed the highest number of victims at 465. Iran has criticized security measures for this year's Hajj and has demanded that all of their dead be returned to Iran for burial.
Kenya's teachers and students have returned to class after a five-week teachers' strike was suspended. The country's teachers' union called the strike at the beginning of the school year after the government said it was unable to pay a court-ordered salary increase. From Nairobi, Jill Craig has more.
Kenya's public school students and teachers returned to classrooms Monday, following the suspension of the national teachers' strike. Teachers' unions agreed to comply with a court order that will give them 90 days to negotiate salary terms with the government. The government maintains it cannot afford to pay the mandated 50% to 60% wage increase. Still, Shukri Abdirahman Malim, a teacher at Jamhuri High School in Nairobi, says he is glad to be back at work.
We are very happy to come back and help the students. Because students were suffering and they were doing nothing at home. And even the parents, they were complaining about keeping their children at home for doing nothing.
Some secondary students at Jamhuri insist they were using their free time productively to prepare for upcoming exams. 11th grader Stephen Kariuki says he is confident the strike will not affect his grades.
I think we're going to excel because most of us were studying alone at home. Some of us were coming at school to study, so I don't think we have lost much. Despite the teachers being away.
12th grader Edwin Ondara says he has been coming to school since the strike began to prepare for exams.
We had a few teachers and few lessons, but today I have seen a great change. Teachers are many in numbers, and they are taking their lessons very seriously.
And because of this seriousness, Kariuki says he hopes his teachers receive a good raise.
Because they're the ones who make everyone in the society, the politicians, the engineers, so they should learn more than the politicians because they pass through their hands.
Kenya's students and parents are grateful the strike is over for at least 90 days, but the long-term outcome of the strike is still unknown. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The European Union's Border Control Agency says it needs nearly 800 more guards to deal with the growing migrant and refugee crisis. The death toll from a stampede during the Hajj in Saudi Arabia a week ago has risen to more than 1,100. And Kenya's teachers and students have returned to class after a five-week teacher strike was suspended. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Pro-democracy activists urge continued support for civil society and election monitoring groups in Africa. They say that democratic forces must keep up with some of the more sophisticated and legalistic ways used by authoritarian governments to stay in power. From Washington, reporter William Eagle reports on a recent roundtable discussion on elections and governance in Africa.
In the next few months, African voters will go to the polls in several countries, including Tanzania, Ivory Coast, Guinea, and the Central African Republic.
Preferably, elections don't simply take place, but they are free and democratic. They happen in the context of freedom of assembly and speech, absent coercion, corruption, and violence. They actually express the will of the people, not the power of a privileged elite.
Dave Peterson is the Africa director of the Washington-based National Endowment for Democracy. He says free and fair elections should include transparency, accountability, and good governance. But that's not always the case. Peterson says voters in Nigeria and Senegal regularly go to the polls, though he says some argue that the two are not particularly well-governed. On the other hand, he says, many development specialists say Ethiopia and Rwanda are well-governed, though their rulers do not tolerate dissent, and the opposition has little or no public presence. He says the goal of his and other pro-democracy groups is to increase the amount of democratic participation in the elections. That's not easy. Observers say there are competing pressures between pro-democracy reformers and governments exercising new ways to maintain power. Jennifer Cook is the Africa director for the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. She says authoritarian regimes are using subtle and legalistic ways to defeat opponents. They include strict media regulations, broadly interpreted security laws, and a crackdown on pro-democracy NGOs that receive foreign funding. Some use the democratically elected legislature or courts to enact constitutional reforms to remove presidential term limits. When confronted with the declining popularity of its long-serving ruler, pro-government reformers in Angola ensured that the president would no longer be elected by direct vote, but by the majority party in parliament.
Even in places like Tanzania, that has so long been kind of the donor darling because it's kind of safe and inoffensive, you've seen and has every single U.S. assistance program pretty much there. You've seen media laws recently that are very troubling. You've seen laws on cybersecurity that allow police to go in and seize computers without much justification. Even laws like the law on statistics that says no statistics may be published unless they are approved by the government. And that is a fundamental challenge to accountable governance and democratic practice.
Pro-democracy groups have their own means of fighting back, including new technologies. Cook says in 2008, Zimbabwe's opposition was able to assert it had won elections with photos of the polling results. In Nigeria's recent polls, social media was used to educate voters on their rights and responsibilities and to monitor the elections. In some regions, pro-democracy NGOs now work across borders, while urbanization and economic advances are creating a more assertive middle class that wants its say in politics.
Rising expectations on the part of African citizens, demands and pressure for democracy from young, more urban populations. Economic growth and investment, even though it's been uneven across the continent, has meant that many of those who were kind of formerly bare subsistence now are part of the consuming, if not middle class, and are able to exert more political pressure and have more time to do that.
Democracy activists say civil society, African regional groups like the Economic Community of West African States, and the international community at large all need to push back against authoritarian rule. Cook says Western policymakers should question the long-term stability of its alliances with undemocratic governments.
And we've seen that in the Cold War, when, you know, Mobutu was our great security partner, Samuel Doe was our great security partner, apartheid South Africa was our strategic partner. So we have to, so there's that that these leaders have to consider. And also a place like Rwanda or Ethiopia, the economic growth that they're experiencing right now, there's eventually going to be a bit of a limit to that unless they're able to open up the economy to a much more kind of and thinking that kind of encourages entrepreneurialism and so forth.
Activists say diaspora groups in the U.S. can play a role in influencing U.S. policy and add to the pressure to open up restrictive regimes. And pro-democracy groups like the National Democratic Institute and International Republican Institute should continue to provide technical assistance to ensure free and fair elections. Together, NGOs and the international community can work with the African Union and other bodies to set continent-wide norms for credible elections. And that should guarantee that upcoming polls fulfill their promise of political and economic development, not just in theory, but in practice. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Africa's largest conference on blindness and visual impairment is underway in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. About 20% of the world's 285 million blind and visually impaired people live in Africa. About 400 representatives from more than 50 countries are attending the four-day event known as Africa Forum. It is held every 4 years and began in 1996. The forum was founded by the Perkins School for the Blind based in Watertown, Massachusetts. Dave Power is president and CEO. He gave the keynote address today. From Kampala, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
Perkins was the first school for the blind, founded in 1829, so it's 186 years old. Most of the schools for the blind in the United States got set up by Perkins, and we've always shared our knowledge. We started bringing teachers from developing countries to Watertown to learn how we teach kids that are visually impaired so they could bring that knowledge back to their countries. But one of the things we started a while back is a conference called the Africa Forum, because there was no one place where the leaders, both government agencies, ministers of education, consumer blindness organizations, and other foundations and that kind of thing, there was no one place where they could come together and discuss common issues across Africa, really with the mission of helping improve education and the lives of people that are blind.
What are the main causes of blindness and people being visually impaired in African and other developing countries?
Really good question. And it does change over time, by the way. In developing countries, most blindness is caused by preventable diseases, river blindness, cataracts. Then there are obviously issues that have to do with genetic causes. There are syndromes that cause blindness everywhere in the world. Another thing that causes blindness is premature birth. The cause of blindness that's the fastest growing source of blindness in the U.S., and I think it will make its way to developing countries, is called cortical visual impairment, or CVI. The issue here is not necessarily anything wrong with the eye. It's the connection between the eye and the brain that is not fully formed because the babies are born so early. That's a whole new source of blindness that the whole field is learning to adapt to.
Now, you gave the keynote address Monday regarding the Sustainable Development Goals, and of course, they're the replacement to the Millennium Development Goals. So tell us about your keynote address.
The Millennial Goals, the UN Goals, had not addressed what the phrase is persons with disabilities explicitly. And so really, the goal setting or the commitment to people that are blind or to education for children was kind of scattered kind of at the country level or at the level of organizations like us. We're a nonprofit, but not at the level of the world community saying, okay, you know, we got to do something about this. That's what's different about the Millennial Goals, because for the first time, there are specific phrases in there that says every child should get education and vocational training so that they can be successful in life. I'm using my own plain language. I'm not reading it. It also says we need to increase the supply of qualified teachers in developing countries. It also says that all of this education and vocational training needs to be available to persons with disabilities.
So briefly describe what specifically needs to be done to achieve those sustainable development goals.
I'm just focusing on a subset of those sustainable goals, focused on children who are visually impaired. I want every one of those children to have a right to an appropriate and quality education, just like their sighted colleagues. And right now, that's not happening in the world. If you look around our world, we have 46 million children who are visually impaired. Half of them have an additional disability, so they may be deaf and blind, or they may have cerebral palsy and blindness, or they have some other issue. So they're complicated to serve. About 90% of them either get no education at all, or if they're in a school, they're in a school that doesn't know how to teach because they're visually impaired. Mostly, you're going to find probably two-thirds of them are at home. You're going to find another, let's say, quarter or so that are in orphanages, even though they may have parents. People don't know what to do with them. They're invisible. So the first thing we got to do is just sort of say, hey, these guys have a right to be in school. That is the first step. And what we do at Perkins International, as we get involved in countries, we've been in some 67 countries over the years. Yeah, the first thing we do is, if there isn't a law, try to get a law in the books that says all kids have a right to an education. And that's a starting point.
Dave Power, president and CEO of the Perkins School for the Blind from Kampala, Uganda. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua.
The first of the Nobel Prizes for the year has been announced. The Nobel Committee in Stockholm has awarded the prize for medicine to scientists from Ireland, Japan, and China. William Campbell from Ireland and Satoshi Omura of Japan shared the prize for their discovery of a novel therapy for infections caused by roundworm parasites. China's Tu Youyou discovered a drug that has significantly reduced the mortality rates for patients suffering from malaria, so he will also share in the prize. The Nobel Prize Committee says these two discoveries have provided humankind with powerful new means to combat these debilitating diseases that affect hundreds of millions of people annually. The consequences in terms of improved human health and reduced suffering are immeasurable. Campbell is currently a research fellow emeritus at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, on the U.S. East Coast. Omura, who holds two doctorate degrees, one in pharmaceutical sciences, the other in chemistry, is a professor emeritus at Japan's Kisato University. Tu is the chief professor at the China Academy of Traditional Medicine.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is happening. VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The European Union's Border Control Agency says it needs nearly 800 more guards to deal with the growing migrant and refugee crisis. The death toll from a stampede during the Hajj in Saudi Arabia a week ago has risen to more than 1,100. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, we focus on Dr. Maradisho Maseti, Africa's regional director at the United Nations World Health Organization. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with African club football.
African club football at the top, Kim. Clubs from Algeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, South Africa, and Tunisia have advanced to the finals in the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup, Africa's two top club tournaments. In the Champions League, USM Alger of Algeria will take on TP Mazembe of the DRC in the two-leg final. And in the Confederation Cup, Orlando Pirates of South Africa will play Etoile Sahel of Tunisia in another two-leg final. In Champions League semifinal results from the weekend, USM Alger played to a scoreless draw with Al Hilal of Sudan. The Algerian club advanced on a 2-1 aggregate, and TP Mazembe, a four-time Champions League winner, advanced on a convincing 5-1 aggregate victory over Sudan's Al Merrekh. Playing at home in Lubumbashi Sunday, Mazembe got two goals from Tanzanian striker Mbwana Samata and a third from Ivorian striker Roger Asale to win 3-0. Mazembe will travel to Algiers for the first leg of the CAF Champions League final, which will be played the weekend of October 30th to November 1st. And the following weekend, the second leg will be played in Lubumbashi. In CAF Confederation Cup semifinal results from the weekend, Orlando Pirates scored a 4-3 road victory Sunday over defending champion Al Ahly of Egypt to win the series 5-3 on aggregate. In the other semifinal, Egyptian club Zamalek defeated visiting Etoile Sahel Saturday 3-0. The Tunisian side, though, moves on thanks to a 5-4 aggregate victory. The Pirates will host the first leg of the Confederation Cup final in Johannesburg the weekend of November 20th to the 22nd, and then the second leg will be played in Tunisia the following weekend. Joining us now with more African football news is the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi.
Good evening, Africa. The African qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia kicks off this Wednesday. Some 26 countries will play over two legs in the first round. The 13 aggregate winners will advance to the second round, where they will join 27 other teams for another round of home and away matches. The 20 aggregate winners will advance to the third and final round. In that round, the 20 teams will be divided into five groups of four teams each. After playing home and away round-robin matches, the winners of each group will qualify to represent Africa at the 2018 FIFA World Cup. In a related development, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has moved the World Cup first-round match from the Central African Republic to Madagascar for safety reasons. The match was moved due to clashes in the capital of the Central African Republic, Bangui, that left about 40 people dead last week. The Central African Republic was due to host Madagascar in Bangui next Saturday, with the return leg in the Malagasy capital, Antananarivo, on October 13th. FIFA said both matches will now be played in Madagascar. Two other African countries will not be able to play their World Cup qualifiers at home next week. Somalia, which has not played at home since October 1986 due to the conflict in that country, hosts Niger in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa on Friday, with the return leg of the first round in Niger's capital, Niamey, 4 days later. And Sierra Leone, still barred from hosting matches because of the Ebola virus, will play away in the first leg of its match against Chad on Saturday, and then host the return leg on October 13th in Port Harcourt, here in Nigeria. It will be the second time that Sierra Leone has used Port Harcourt as venue for one of its qualifiers. Last month, Sierra Leone held African champion Ivory Coast to a goalless draw in Port Harcourt in the 2017 African Nations Cup qualifier. Turning to women's football, Cameroon came from behind to beat Zimbabwe 2-1 on Saturday in the final round of first leg qualifier for the 2016 Olympic Games women's football. The Cameroonians would have to avoid defeat in the return leg in a fortnight in Harare to realize their Olympic dream. For its part, South Africa was held goalless by visiting Equatorial Guinea in Johannesburg. The decider will be played in Malabo, capital of Equatorial Guinea, in 2 weeks. The two aggregate winners will represent Africa at the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
Voice of America.
In African women's basketball, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Senegal, which won a record-extending 11th continental title over the weekend in Yaoundé, Cameroon. The Senegalese women defeated host Cameroon 81-66 in the final. As a result, Senegal also earned direct qualification to next year's Olympic women's basketball tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And just to put Senegal's domination of African women's basketball in perspective, with that 11th African title, the Senegalese are 8 trophies ahead of the next best nation, the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has won 3 Afrobaskets for women. Let's take a look at some of the honors that were handed out in Yaoundé. Senegal's Aya Traoré was named Most Valuable Player at the Afrobasket 2015 tournament in Cameroon. The 32-year-old Traoré played college basketball here in the United States at Purdue University. She was one of 5 players named to the Afrobasket 2015 All-Star team. The four others are Diolinda Engulela of Mozambique, Ramses Lonlack of Cameroon, Geraldine Robert of Gabon. And Geraldine, by the way, was the leading scorer in Yaounde. She averaged more than 20 points a game. And rounding out the 2015 AfroBasket for Women All-Star team is Adaora Elonu of Nigeria. The Nigerian women beat Angola 65-55 in the bronze medal match in Yaounde. And that was a big win for Nigeria because it keeps alive their hopes of going to the Rio Games next year in Brazil. The second and third place teams in Yaounde, Cameroon and Nigeria, now advance to a 12-team Olympic qualifying tournament, which will be held in June 2016. The top five teams in that tournament qualify for the Rio Olympics. More women's basketball news now on the sunny side of sports. The Indiana Fever defeated the host Minnesota Lynx 75-69 in Game 1 of the WNBA Finals. Breanne January had 19 points and 6 assists for Indiana. Our VOA basketball fans will remember, this is a rematch of the 2012 WNBA Finals, in which Indiana defeated Minnesota 3-1 for the club's only championship. Marissa Coleman added 16 points for the Fever in Game 1. Indiana made all 16 of its free throws in the game. Minnesota, meanwhile, missed 8 free throws and turned the ball over 15 times to lose the opener on its home court. Game 2 in the best-of-5 WNBA Finals is Tuesday night in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Some African athletics news now on the Voice of America. Kenya once again swept the men's and women's titles at an international marathon. Boaz Kiprono and Joan Keegan waved the Kenyan flag Sunday at the Bournemouth Marathon in England. Despite windy conditions on England's south coast, Kiprono set a course record, clocking 2 hours and 16 minutes even. And Keegan won the women's race in Bournemouth in 2 hours, 36 minutes, and 47 seconds. The marathon was part of a weekend of running in Bournemouth, which also included a 5K race, a 10K race, a half marathon, and junior races. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, two cities in Zimbabwe, one in China, cooperate in improving business and infrastructure development. And next, we focus on Dr. Matsidi Somaweti, Africa Regional Director at the United Nations World Health Organization. But first, some music. Here is Famous from Sierra Leone with Koporodon.
Famous. Brown here. Copper done, love done.
Now you be sad. If I not eat, we no go eat a lie. If I not sleep, we no go sleep a lie. Copper done, one for left behind. Money done, one for left behind. If I not get, we go to be a me. Where we don't cook, we go cook a lot of the end. Copper done, one.
From Sierra Leone with Copperdon.
A delegation from China's Guangzhou City recently visited Zimbabwe to finalize a twinning agreement with Harare City. The sister city agreement will let the two cities cooperate to improve budgeting, governance, business, and infrastructure development. Erwin Chifara has details from the capital of Zimbabwe.
Speaking at a meeting to finalize the twinning agreement, Harare Mayor Bernard Manyenyeni said the former Sunshine City stands to benefit from Guangzhou as it has many opportunities to offer, especially in terms of business. He said the fact that Guangzhou is more developed than Harare is a plus for the city that has so much to learn and develop.
They are solid on infrastructure, they are solid on waste management, housing and construction. Their financial centers are international hubs. So for a city like ours, in need of technical expertise, in need of funding, this is a great opportunity for us.
Manyenyeni said Zimbabwe is not going into the arrangement with a begging bowl in hand, but would want Guangzhou to exploit opportunities and invest in Harare. Leader of the Guangzhou delegation, Peng Menjiang, said the Harare arrangement is part of efforts by China to strengthen cooperation between the two countries.
We come and visit Zimbabwe and hope this time we can have more exchange between Guangzhou and Harare.
He said Guangzhou, as a city of more than 10 million, had a lot to offer Harare. He invited their counterparts in Zimbabwe to visit the Chinese city and explore opportunities. City residents like Maina Pengen said any arrangement that would improve service delivery was welcome. She said with another Chinese company already upgrading the city's water reticulation system, she expected Guangzhou City to assist in other areas such as waste management that Harare seems to be grappling with.
There's a lot of dirt everywhere. Bins are left to overflow. If we could get help in such areas, I think the twinning program would be a success.
Harare Metropolitan Residents Association spokesperson Marvelous Kumalo said while they would normally applaud any meaningful twinning arrangements between Harare and any other international cities, they were unhappy with the way the Chinese in particular have handled their deals with the Harare City Council.
It is suspicious because we have known those from the east to come to Zimbabwe and actually not work out on an equal footing, but treat Zimbabwe as a second fiddle country and actually benefit more instead of a 50-50 benefit.
Harare has twinning arrangements with cities like Munich of Germany that have seen massive capacity building programs being implemented and computer upgrading, resulting in improved water billing and revenue collection in the capital city. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Dr. Matsi Doso Maweti took the helm as Africa Regional Director at the United Nations World Health Organization last spring. She inherited an office critics called too slow and bureaucratic in response to the Ebola crisis. Dr. Maweti spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips about her priorities for WHO reform.
Yes, it is a challenge, but I think it's also an opportunity. What I'm working on doing in WHO, first of all, is to get all our teams focused on delivering. It's very important to have health systems, as we like to call them, that function. So to be able to have enough nurses, midwives, technicians, doctors, specialists where they are needed, in order to deliver a basic package of healthcare services to all people and not concentrated in the cities, as is the experience in many African countries and as was the experience in these three countries. Guinea, where the Ebola outbreak epidemic started, Sierra Leone and Liberia. We have big gaps in human resources for health. There are some places where people are simply not in touch with the health system in any way whatsoever, and they need to travel significant distances to get to a basic clinic where they will find a nurse and not necessarily find a doctor. They may not find a functioning laboratory to be able to diagnose their illness, and they very often will not find basic medication for some of the common problems that people have.
Is Ebola continues to be a big challenge then?
Ebola and other epidemic-prone diseases, cholera. Cholera is almost endemic in quite a number of countries. We have, of course, the risk of influenza globally. So I would say the problem is the readiness of countries to be able to detect, diagnose, and control outbreaks in general. Ebola was just an example, a particularly dramatic one. But we have in WHO something called the International Health Regulations. It's a definition of countries' responsibilities to stop the spread of disease internationally if they start in their territory. So there's a requirement that countries need to build their capacity to diagnose, monitor, and contain outbreaks. So this is one of the big issues that need to be addressed now.
Now, polio is kind of a good news item.
Very encouraging, and we are very pleased that we are about to certify that Nigeria is now polio-free. Of course, we have to go through a couple more years of surveillance to confirm that, but I believe that the Nigerian people and the African people deserve a celebration of all the effort that they made, as well as the Global Polio Eradication Initiative partners that stood by them when we had a deadline, we reached it, and we hadn't achieved it. So I think this is a very positive, great moment for Africa, this achievement.
You actually look really happy to say this.
I am happy to say this. We have seen African countries delve into this work, organize all these campaigns. They kept at it with their partners. The partners also have to be thanked for having kept at it with the resources that were needed for these campaigns. I think it is a very positive moment for health in Africa.
Is there some way that your own personal experience treating patients and being with patients, and of course you come from a medical family, comes to play and you're able to remember that in your job as this, I think, very important director now?
Yes, I think so. I worked a lot in pediatrics. It's one of the most fondly remembered periods in my career, frankly. But I remember in the ward in which I was working, as part of asking after the family background, I'd always ask, so who's the father? The answer would very much be, the child has no father. I noticed very often that it was young mothers whose children were the most severely malnourished. Single women who had a baby with a man, quite often young women, where there was no way of making the fathers take responsibility for their children. Coming back as a 25-year-old, as no, child has a father. Father must take responsibility. You have to go after him in order for him to take his responsibilities. I'll refer you to this friend who's a lawyer. And the grandmothers would come and see me and say, doctor, that we don't want to do that because the father may do something. We may have the money and the child may die. People's belief in witchcraft. And it took me ages working with my friends to try and convince people that your child will be saved, but the father must take his responsibility. He has a lawyer who for free can help you to pursue him. And we did eventually manage to pursue some of these men. Everybody must take that responsibility for people to be healthy, including unmarried dads. I was very indignant as a young doctor that all these beliefs getting in the way of getting justice for these women and their children. from these men. But that's why I think it's very important to know what people believe, work with them through their beliefs until you can get them, hopefully, working in the direction that you want.
That was Dr. Matsidi Somaweti talking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York about her priorities for WHO reform. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up with this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A resurgence of sectarian violence in the Central African Republic, or CAR, raises grave concerns for that country's political transition and respect for the human rights of all its citizens. Many fear that the violence, in which 41 people have died since September 25th, could degenerate into civil war if not contained soon. The international community has been unanimous in its condemnation of the attacks on and among civilians and against humanitarian workers. We have also called for the perpetrators to be brought to justice and appealed for militias to lay down arms now. Meanwhile, more than 1.5 million Central Africans have expressed their wish for a break with the old ways of violence by registering to vote in elections originally scheduled for later this month. It is critical that the elections take place to allow a democratically elected government to lead the citizens of the Central African Republic to lasting peace and recovery. The United States reaffirms its support for the ongoing political transition process and congratulates transitional authorities for recently completing a draft constitution. Gerard Hodel, with the U.S. delegation to the UNHRC, stated, "The Central African Republic has a unique opportunity in the coming months to move decisively toward peace, reconciliation, and justice. Clearly, stopping the violence and seizing that opportunity will be critical for the country's future. The U.S., while encouraged by recent handovers of several hundred child soldiers to UNICEF, remains deeply concerned about the several thousand children who remain in armed groups. The U.S. strongly recommends that the transitional government, with international community support, prioritize their return. The U.S. also condemns attacks by armed groups against humanitarian convoys and peacekeepers and fully supports the effort of the U.N. mission in the Central African Republic and French forces under Operation Sangaré to work with the Central African Republic authorities to reestablish law and order. And we welcome the UN Secretary General's pledge to enforce a zero-tolerance policy for UN forces who sexually abuse Central Africans, including children. The U.S. is committed to working with transitional authorities and its international partners to help the CAR's transition to a democracy where the rights of all citizens are respected."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Next on Let's Talk. turncoat. According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.